From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Frank Browning with Fresh Air. Terry Gross has the week off. On this edition of Fresh Air, reporter-turned-novelist Bill McPherson tells us how he stumbled into the Romanian Revolution and how that event turned him back into a reporter. Also today, writer Lorene Carey tells us how she, a black kid from Philadelphia, ended up attending a very white, old-line New England prep school. It's the subject of her new memoir. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Graham Parker. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq will begin releasing thousands of Kuwaiti detainees, perhaps as soon as tomorrow. That's according to officials with the International Committee for the Red Cross. From Kuwait City, NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
Red Cross officials say the Iraqis will begin releasing the Kuwaitis over the next few days. The detainees will be returned to Kuwait via Saudi Arabia, the officials say. Iraq is thought to be holding several thousand Kuwaitis, many of whom were abducted just days before the Iraqi withdrawal. The Iraqis released more than 1,000 of those detainees about 10 days ago. Since then, several dozen more Kuwaitis have made it across the border on their own, many saying they had been liberated by rebels fighting the government in the southern city of Basra. Kuwait's Prime Minister, Sheikh Saad al-Abdullah al-Sabah, said the Iraqi government has been slow to release more than 6,000 remaining detainees because of the turmoil in southern Iraq. I'm Deborah Wong in Kuwait City.
The Crown Prince of Kuwait told a group of U.S. congressmen today that security and reconstruction would take precedence over democracy in his country. Prince Saad Abdullah al-Sabah was meeting with a delegation led by House Majority Whip Richard Gephardt and Minority Leader Bob Michael. Al-Sabah said that Parliament will be restored, but not until Kuwait's reconstruction is well underway. The ruling family dissolved Parliament in 1986. Yesterday, a Kuwaiti minister of state said elections would be held within 1 year at most. The members of Congress also questioned the prince about alleged human rights abuses against Palestinians in Kuwait. Al-Sabah merely said that the Kuwaiti people will never commit the same crimes they were subjected to by Iraqi troops. The National Transportation Safety Board has begun a week-long hearing in Detroit in an effort to determine why two planes collided on a runway at Metropolitan Airport last December. 8 people died in the accident. Don Gagne has more.
Transcripts of cockpit conversations show that in the moments before the crash, pilots of both planes were having difficulty in the heavy fog. In an opening statement today, the NTSB's James Burnett said there are many questions to which they hope to find some answers this week.
Why is there no ground radar at the Detroit airport? Was the weather worse than reported, and was there pressure on the controllers to keep the airport open? Were the airport runway signs confusing to the pilots, and did the runway lighting operate correctly?
Burnett, citing another collision in Los Angeles 6 weeks ago, says there are still far too many accidents and close calls at U.S. airports. He also criticized the Federal Aviation Administration for being too slow to respond to NTSB concerns in this area. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 18 points to close at 2,929.95. Declines edged advances in active trading. This is NPR News. Observers say that there may be new hope for the release of Western hostages in Lebanon, including 6 Americans. Iran's news agency reported today that President Hashemi Rafsanjani met with officials from Hezbollah, the Lebanese terrorist group that's believed to control the hostages. The report didn't say whether the hostages were discussed, but news reports from Beirut indicated that Iran has decided to act to get the hostages released. Oregon Democrat Les O'Coin today announced that he's joined the ranks of those who support tougher controls on gun ownership. Over the past 16 years, O'Coin has voted with the National Rifle Association, which is opposed to such measures. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more.
O'Coin's switch was timed to coincide with a hearing this week on legislation that would mandate a 7-day waiting period for purchasers of handguns. The legislation is known as the Brady Bill, named after President Reagan's former press secretary, who was injured in an assassination attempt on the president. Alcoin faces stiff opposition from his home district over his new position in support of the Brady Bill. The NRA has over 60,000 members in Oregon, but Alcoin says crime statistics and the NRA's unwillingness to soften its position caused him to change his mind.
I support the right of a law-abiding citizen to own a gun. But that right does not apply to felons, to the mentally disturbed, or to drug addicts who are proscribed by federal law from owning guns.
House Speaker Tom Foley, who opposes the Brady Bill, has promised the legislation will reach the floor for a vote sometime this spring. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Police in Detroit said that a young veteran of the Gulf War was shot to death today while he was home on leave. Army Specialist Anthony Riggs was reportedly killed as he was helping his wife to move from the home of a family member. He was 22. Riggs was a member of a Patriot missile battery during the war, and he was home on leave from a base in Texas. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
I'm Frank Browning, and this is Fresh Air. A year ago last Christmas, Bill McPherson, the novelist, flew to Germany with a friend. They wanted to see the Berlin Wall before it was finally obliterated into a pile of rocks, a last gruesome monument of the Cold War. Then they spent several days lounging along the Grand Canal in Venice. A bit of politics, a bit of history, a bit of luxury. And then home, or that's the way it was supposed to be. But along the way, Bill McPherson, or rather his imagination, got caught in Romania. The collapse of the Ceausescu dictatorship and the execution of Ceausescu and his wife galvanized all Europe through Christmas week. McPherson's friend returned to the United States, but he stayed on, drawn into the maelstrom of revolution, terror, and hope, which have marked the Eastern European country for the last year. Welcome to Fresh Air, Bill.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Bill, you used to be a newspaper man. You wrote editorials for the Washington Post, but for the last decade or so, you've been known as a novelist and a rather elegant stylist of character and scene. What drew you back to reporting, and of all places, to a land that, like Romania, that seems almost medieval?
Well, that's a good question. It is an almost medieval place. I was in the middle of my third novel, and I seemed to be having a little trouble with it. I was not happy with what I was doing, and when I took that trip, and I was immediately sucked into this situation that I wanted to understand, and I suppose one of the things that attracted me to it was the kind of mystery that was there, and the I guess I would say the evil that I saw. I think that's the only word to describe it.
The evil.
Yeah, it's kind of an evil place in some ways. I mean, not an evil place. You see evil in the world, you see it clearly in Romania. You don't see it so clearly in the United States or elsewhere.
What was the first sign of evil?
Well, let me tell you, I'm not sure that this was the first sign, but this was an obvious sign. At the end of February, about 1 or 1:30 in the afternoon, I was passing a footbridge in Timișoara, and I noticed a crowd on the bridge, or a few people, not a crowd. And I stopped and went over, and I looked down at what they were seeing, and it was a man who had apparently committed suicide. I was horrified. I'd never seen anything like that before. But as I was looking down, he was lying on the bank of the river, this small river. And as I was looking down at him, I thought, something seems strange about it. And I thought, he's not blue. And then I thought, I thought you're supposed to be blue if you hang yourself. But then I thought, his position is very strange. He was in rigor mortis at that point. This was 1 or 2 in the afternoon. And it was not the position of a man who had been hanging. And then I saw that there didn't appear to be any bruises or swelling around his neck, although the rope was still there. And I asked someone, they said they'd heard he'd been cut down and put on the riverbank. It became clear to me that this was not a suicide. The next day, or a couple days later, there was a small item in the local newspaper, maybe three or four lines, saying a man had been found on the riverbank. Apparently, it was not a suicide. I've tried to find out the man's name. I do know his first name. I know a little something about him, but very little. I know he was a member of the first revolutionary government in Timișoara in December 1989, and that for some reason or other he was killed, whether he was an informer, whether it was some kind of rivalry, I don't know. But that's what I mean by evil, I guess. And then the miners, of course, when the miners came to Bucharest.
Now, that's last summer when the revolutionary government brought miners in to break up a student occupation in the town square, right?
Right.
Paint for us a picture of that scene and how you came to witness it and what happened to you.
The night before, there'd been shooting on and off all night. There was great turmoil. The police headquarters was in flames. It's a question as to who set the police headquarters in flames. I mean, there's evidence that indicates it was a provocation on the part of the government. But there had been great commotion and turmoil the night of June 13th to June 14th. At 4:20 in the morning, the last shooting stopped. At 4:40, I mean, I remember this so clearly, I decided I would go to sleep. I could lie down. And I went to lie down on the couch in this room, overlooking, in the Intercontinental Hotel, overlooking the University Square, where the demonstrations had taken place. And as I was drifting off, I thought I heard a strange noise. And I thought, what can that be? And I thought, oh, forget it, because I didn't really, I was tired, I was exhausted. I'd actually been dodging bullets the night before. I just wanted to go to sleep. And I thought, no, get up and look. Why else are you here? So I got up and I dragged myself out to the balcony, and I didn't know what I was seeing at first. It was just in that light before dawn, and it was very, very dim. It was very hard to see. I looked down, and I couldn't tell what I was seeing at first, but I thought, in fact, it looked like fireflies. All these miners, maybe 500, with their lamps, their miners' lamps, flickering, and this strange swish of these sticks they were carrying. And they were chanting, Golan, Golan. Golan is a sort of word for hooligan, which is what the president of the country had described the people in University Square as hooligans. And all you could see were these white sticks kind of flashing about, and these lights flickering. They kept flickering them on and off. And then as it got a little lighter, I mean, within 2 or 3 minutes, you could see that there were several hundred men in their mining outfits, and that they were, I thought, my God, they're miners. And there was a little pause, a space between them, and then another 500. Within an hour or two, less than that, within an hour, there were thousands of miners in University Square. And they were looking for Golan. And they went into the, first I saw them run into the university building, which faces the square, and from the balcony of that building, they had, the student protesters had led the protests. They ran into that building. They ran into the Faculty of Architecture, which faces it, and was a in the Faculty of Architecture, there was an opposition radio station that was considered particularly offensive. They seized that building. You could see them on the, eventually they got to the roof. You could see them on the roof waving in triumph. And anyone who walked through the square Although God knows why anybody would, but...
Did you go out?
Eventually. The miners arrived. It was actually 5 in the morning when they came to the square. And about... I made a couple little... I went down to the lobby of the hotel thinking I would go out. I looked and thought, maybe I better not. I went a little tiny ways out the door, and I thought I would just see what weapons they were carrying. And I saw the weapons, which were pretty impressive, and I thought, they had drills. I mean, they had these drills. One of them came up to my chest.
They were carrying drills?
Yeah, a miner's drill, and they had... pipes and clubs and tree limbs, chains and rubber hoses, just chains, or just plain chains.
And then they cleared the square.
The square was definitely cleared of everything but miners. But then a little while later, about 9 o'clock, I was with another journalist, and it seemed the violence, the first wave of violence was subsiding somewhat, and we decided it was safe to go out. And these are reasonably safe, so we ventured a little ways out. And these guys, they said everyone they'd beaten up, I talked to one of the guys, or they didn't say beaten up, arrested was how they put it. They were prostitutes, the women were prostitutes, a lot of women were beaten up.
The miners claimed that the women
were
prostitutes.
Yes, of course, they had no way of knowing, and I mean, it seemed highly unlikely. They looked like fairly normal people to me. They were drug addicts, or they had drugs on them. They had inflammatory political material, and one of them showed me, actually, the inflammatory political material, and it was a copy of the Constitution of the United States, one of the things that the USIA, I guess it is, prints them by the thousands, and... he couldn't read.
The miner couldn't read it.
No, he didn't know what it was.
My guest is William McPherson, reporter and novelist. He spent the last year writing about the aftermath of the Romanian Revolution. We'll take a short break. This is Fresh Air. For those of you just tuning in, I'm talking with William McPherson. He spent the last year in Romania preparing a book on the country. What is it that's drawn you, a novelist, a man who really hasn't done this sort of work, to do this particular part of the world? Is there something about the nature of evil that fascinates you in the world?
Well, yes, I suppose. I mean, I think that fascinates most everybody, but also I guess I left out equally important, more important, is this struggle for freedom. I mean, these people struggling to be free. It's a very basic, a very moving, and in a way, I guess, a very romantic kind of idea. These people who have been oppressed, horribly oppressed, desperately wanting to be free. And also very afraid.
You've spent the better part of a year in Romania.
That's right.
What did people ask you? What did they seek from you?
Oh, oh, they ask me all sorts of things. I mean, they ask me the most amazing things, that questions that I have absolutely no answer to. I mean, they'll ask me how they should how to make the economy work. I mean, I don't know how to make the economy work. I'm not an economist. They ask me, they say, how does democracy work? You know, tell us about democracy. They ask me, how much does your camera cost? They want to know, how much money do you make? How large is your apartment? Do you live in a house? Do you live in an apartment? How much do you pay for rent? And of course, the dollar value, I mean, there's a lot of questions about how much things cost, questions that would be considered quite rude in the United States, but there are simple, genuine curiosity because they want to know how the world works. And they have no, in Romania, prices of things have no relation to cost. Until October of this year, the end of October, it was possible to take a plane flight from Bucharest to Timișoara for, I believe it was 347 lei, which at the time was the equivalent of $3.47.
$3.47 for a plane ride of that distance.
Yes, I mean, it doesn't pay them to start the engine. and the more people they have on the plane, the more money they must be losing because of the, you know, they use more fuel. Those prices have changed. But they're still very reasonable by Western standards. I mean, the price in Romania does not relate much to the actual cost of producing something.
So do you have the sense of people slipping out of the cave and looking at you as a person from another world?
Yes, I'm kind of exotic and I'm rich. I say I'm rich. Any foreigner in Romania is rich. If you have dollars, if you have any dollars, you're rich. I mean, no matter how poor you may feel or what your, no matter what your financial situation really is, in Romania, you are rich and you have freedom. You have a passport. You can leave. These people cannot leave. The wall came down, but of course, now the West is busily erecting another wall to keep people from to keep the Eastern Europeans in. It's very, very difficult to get a visa, and even if you do get a visa, how can you afford to spend to buy lunch in the West? I mean, you can't. Most people can't.
Bill, let me ask you what you learned about yourself. Bill McPherson, the novelist who went to see what happened to the Romanian Revolution. What happened to you in this last year? What did you learn about yourself?
Well, that's hard to say. I guess one thing I learned is that I'm not a coward, and that was sort of nice to learn.
What do you mean?
Hmm?
What do you mean? You learned you were not a coward.
Well, I mean, I did things that I would never have imagined doing. I was in situations that I would never have imagined being in. I never imagined I'd be dodging bullets, for God's sake.
That's right. You went for a vacation in Berlin with a little bit of time in the Grand Canal.
That's right. And then suddenly I'm in Romania with all these, you know, with all these clothes meant for the Grand Canal. I found myself confronted with a very strange situation, a situation that was very mysterious to me, a place where corruption was everywhere, where no one trusted anyone, and there were no facts, only rumors. And I managed to, you know, survive that so far. And even enjoy it. Because I do enjoy it. I mean, nobody is forcing me to be there. I'm fascinated by the country, and I want to understand it better. I think I'll only the way I work, I tend to, when I write, I know what I think when I've written it. And before I write it, I'm not exactly sure what I think.
Well, keep thinking and look over your shoulder frequently.
Okay, thanks, Frank.
My guest has been William McPherson. He's finishing a book on the last year in Romania. An excerpt appeared recently in the literary magazine Granta. The Resuscitation of a Hanged Man is a new novel by Dennis Johnson. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Leonard English, the hero and victim of Dennis Johnson's hallucinatory fourth novel, tried to hang himself back in Kansas. Partly, this was because he was depressed by his job selling medical supplies, including a new surgical stapler. Partly, it was because of an absence of meaning in his life, an absence of God, a missing sign, and a missing person. But he's not in Kansas anymore. English has relocated to Provincetown, the end, if not of the earth, at least of Massachusetts, a circle of hell where men wear skirts and women love women, and everybody is just as confused as he is. In this hell, working part-time as a late-night radio disc jockey and part-time as a private detective on electronic surveillance, English will look for a vanished artist, discover a paramilitary conspiracy, be kidnapped and beaten up, try to kill someone while wearing women's clothes, and fall in love with a lesbian. Some of this is very funny, but most of it is very scary. Because resuscitation of a hanged man is really about the damnation of souls. It's as if, in Provincetown, English had been ganged up on by Old Testament prophets, metaphysical poets, and every bad dream in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. On the beach, oppressed by the water and light, the damned cavort, a young woman reclines toward the sun with the incense of her secrets rising from her. A man squatting at a sandcastle vomits up the teeth of the wolves broken off in his flesh in a previous life. The music they listen to is the hum of an EKG, a dentist's drill, a vacuum cleaner, or the high test tone of a radio station. Along with the paramilitary conspiracy, called the Truth Infantry, there may be an ecclesiastical conspiracy. English wants to confess, but in every church the priests appear to be eavesdropping on him. The booth is bugged. Martyrs stare down at him like cannibals. As water and wine are transformed into body and blood, people pass from life into meat. The dead hang, not from a cross, but from the trees in the woods. Our Lady of the Snows is no longer a nurturing mother, but an enchantress, a tantalizing absence. Has Jesus himself been kidnapped, held hostage? Can a private eye track down a missing God? Did God, asks English, really kill himself? If so, is English the Second Coming? Americans don't write this kind of novel, unless it's Flannery O'Connor, who wore herself out on her cross, or Robert Stone in iconoclastic rage, or Nathaniel West, Miss Lonely Hearts Among the Locusts. Graham Greene comes to mind, and he's mentioned in the book, as are Simenon and C.S. Lewis and Coleridge and Kierkegaard. But Hanged Man also seems to me extremely French and existential, like The Stranger or Nausea. Johnson himself goes on about Simone Weil, the Parisian intellectual who intimidated even Sartre and Beauvoir with her superior moral earnestness, a young woman who starved herself to death to prove herself worthy of God. Simone Weil shows up here, in a diner, very thin indeed, to give English directions. The real Simone Weil once said, "Every time I think of the crucifixion of Christ, I commit the sin of envy." That sounds to me an awful lot like Leonard English himself in this sad and savage novel about a soul lost at sea, lost in metaphoric code.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Resuscitation of a Hanged Man by Dennis Johnson. I'm Frank Browning, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Frank Browning with Fresh Air. When Lorene Carey got a scholarship to a private prep school in New England, it was an opportunity to be exposed to the white Northeastern establishment. But it was also an opportunity for her classmates to be exposed to a black teenager. Coming up, Lorene Carey tells us what it's like to live between two worlds. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Struck by Lightning, the new album from Graham Parker. For years, Parker's albums have reflected an anger at the world. Ken says now his music's on friendlier terms. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to refugees reaching Kuwait from southern Iraq, several thousand bodies are lying on the streets of Basra, victims there of civil unrest. Refugees also say that helicopters, which rebels say are from Iran, are airlifting supplies to rebel-held areas in the city. These reports cannot be confirmed. Because of a lack of food, prices are extremely high. Refugees say a 110-pound bag of rice is $108, with the same amount of flour costing $195. In Beirut, there's renewed hope for 11 Western hostages, including six Americans. President Rafsanjani met with the senior leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah party, believed to be holding those hostages. Mike Theodulu has more.
Few in Lebanon believe the hostages will soon be freed, but they say the wheels are in motion. The Syrian-backed Lebanese army recently moved into areas previously controlled by the kidnap groups. One Lebanese newspaper said troops raided Hezbollah strongholds in southern Beirut, searching for the hostages, but it's believed these have been moved to the eastern Bekaa Valley. While the pro-Iranian kidnappers detest Saddam Hussein, it's thought they want the dust to settle on the Gulf War before they free the Westerners. They don't want it to look like they're rewarding the U.S. for attacking Islamic Iraq. When President Rafsanjani met with the Hezbollah leader, Sheikh Subi Tufali, today, it's likely the Sheikh raised the kidnappers' other concerns. Freedom for the Muslim cleric Sheikh Obeid, who was kidnapped by Israeli commandos, and guarantees that the U.S. won't attack Hezbollah after the hostages are freed. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Hundreds of families stood in pouring rain today in Norfolk to welcome home the crew of the USS Sylvania. Gail Converse of member station WHRV has more on the story.
Despite the high winds and rain, well-wishers were out in full force for the arrival of the Navy's first ship to come home from the Red Sea and Operation Desert Storm. The 430-member crew of the combat store ship USS Sylvania were greeted at the world's largest U.S. naval base by family and friends from across the country. Some traveled for days just to reach Pier 20 and the first glimpse in over 7 months of loved ones. As the Sylvania dropped anchor, one Navy wife expressed her hopes for the moment at hand and for the future.
This is a wonderful feeling, and I hope it lasts for a long time.
The USS Sylvania was part of a ship-to-ship resupply effort in the Red Sea for Desert Storm, and it was the largest logistics effort mounted by the U.S. Navy since Vietnam. For National Public Radio, I'm Gail Converse in Norfolk, Virginia.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 18 points to close at 2,929.95 in active trading. This is NPR News. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to consider a case involving more protection for attorneys who oppose the way that some of the dues to their bar association are paid. The court agreed to hear an appeal by a Florida lawyer who opposes some of the stands on public issues taken by the state bar association. Last year, the high court ruled in a California case that attorneys are entitled to keep such dues to protect their free speech rights. As many as 100,000 people demonstrated in cities in the eastern part of Germany tonight to protest growing unemployment. Deidre Berger reports from Leipzig.
Less than half a year after unification, the Leipzigers took to the streets to protest the lack of jobs in their region. The rally was sponsored by local unions and citizens groups. Speakers condemned the tendency of the Bonn government to shut down former state-run enterprises instead of modernizing and salvaging the plants. Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who turned down an invitation to attend this evening's rally, was loudly booed at the demonstration. Organizers announced a march to Bonn in the spring to demand a stop to spiraling unemployment rates in the former Eastern Germany that could reach 50% by summer. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Leipzig.
Former President Richard Nixon will travel to Lithuania this weekend. Nixon is in the Soviet Union now at the invitation of the Institute of World Economy and International Relations. The U.S. government has never recognized the Soviet takeover of the Baltic republics. In Poland, some 500 shipyard workers are on strike at Gdansk. Some 7,000 workers are employed at that shipyard. The leadership of the Solidarity Union does not support the walkout. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. 20 years ago, Lorene Carey came home from her job at Woolworths one Friday night and got a phone call that changed her life. A family friend told her that New England's super elite St. Paul's prep school was looking for black girls, and she should apply. A year later, she was enrolled. Lorene Carey has written about what St. Paul's did to her life and what she's done to St. Paul's in a new book called Black Ice. Welcome to Fresh Air, Lorene.
Thank you.
Well, there are a lot of these episodes in the book about what the expectations are, what the terminologies are, really coming to understand the world of rich white people. And those rich white people often sound very strange.
Well, I hope not too strange. I hope that I haven't done a parody of people. The world seemed strange to me. The culture seemed strange in some ways. But in fact, as I say in the book, I was prepared for that's what I was raised for. I was raised to go to St. Paul's, even though I didn't know it, almost as much as the kids who were supposed to have gone there.
Tell me more about that. You were raised in a black middle-class family in Philadelphia.
Yes. We called it middle class, although I later learned that black middle class is sometimes different from standard white American middle class. But we thought it was middle class, and it was just fine.
Uh-huh. Well, what is that difference?
I think I've heard some people in the community say that middle class in black America is if you have a job. You know, you have a job and a home and you're doing okay. But there's a sense of vulnerability in the black middle class that I didn't notice among middle class white students that I met at St. Paul's and then folks I've met later.
You talk in the book about the first time you drove up to see the campus at St. Paul's with your family, your parents, your little sister, and a black teacher there was, I believe, describing, one of the teachers there was describing what life at St. Paul's had been like, and he spoke about tea dances. And I guess tea dances aren't there anymore now that it's a co-ed school. But the way you wrote about it was so remarkable. It really did seem as though you were almost a young anthropologist going out to describe the rituals of these peculiar people. I wonder if you could read from us just a paragraph or so.
Sure,
that time.
What was a tea dance, I wondered? Tea meant little girls with clean hands and faces sipping out of china cups, eating butter cookies with raspberry jam. Teas belonged in church or in childhood. A dance, to the contrary, meant teenagers in a basement, black lights, red bulbs, music jamming its way through our shoes and up into our feet. It meant arms in the air, whistles, a soul train down the middle of the room, whipping out new steps, nice and casual, as if we hadn't spent all week practicing. It meant sweat steaming out of the tops of our heads, shrinking afros worthy of Angela Davis down to dreaded TWAs, teeny-weeny afros. A dance meant watching sharp so that no amorous brother spoiled our hot pants. Tea had nothing to do with it.
My guest is Lorene Carey. She's just finished a memoir of her transition from living in a black middle-class family in Philadelphia to the elite St. Paul's prep school. At another point, after you had gotten to St. Paul's, we're talking with friends there. You were trying to find your place and deal with why you had come. And you use a phrase called turnout.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And let me read a little passage back to you that fascinated me. You say, I had no idea that wealth and privilege could confer real advantages beyond the obvious ones sprawled before us. Instead, I believed that rich white people were like poodles, overbred, inbred, degenerate. All the coddling and permissiveness would have a bad effect, I figured, now that they were up against those of us who'd lived a real life in a real world. And this is about turning out, that you were going to turn out. Or
right.
At one point you said you're going to turn the mothers out.
Right.
Tell us about turning out.
Turning out. You're supposed to turn it out. You're supposed to really do it up. Translation, I suppose, is get good grades, do well at the school, function socially and athletically, and just all around do well. But turning it out had to do with will and self-assertion and making the experience one's own. And don't go up there and piddle around and stay in the corners and act like, excuse me, I don't mean to get in the way here at your school. I mean, don't go in there. Go in there and do it.
And not only do it on their terms, but teach them something about you, seems to be what you're saying.
Well, yeah, I mean, I accepted that was part of the reason we were there. I think most of us did. Someone said to me that surely you couldn't have known that at 15. I think many of us assume that we were experiments. You can't walk into a room and not know that part of the reason we were there was to, you know, round out the other students' education. We had that sense of that as part of the reason we'd gone.
That as black people,
yes.
You were specimens for the education of rich white kids.
Specimens might be a little too clinical a word, but sure, we were there to help them learn about black people, yeah. That's certainly what I believed, and I don't think that's completely wrong.
My guest is Laureen Carey. Her new memoir is called Black Ice. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Laureen Carey. Her new memoir is called Black Ice. Laureen, we were talking about what this school, St. Paul's, was about, what their expectations were about you, what your role was there. And at one point you talk, I guess you were in your last semester of your last year, you were vice president of the student body.
Yeah.
And Archibald Cox, the former Watergate prosecutor who was fired by Richard Nixon,
right.
Came to see you.
Yeah.
And there was kind of a, it seems like there was sort of an epiphany for you and probably not for him. Why don't you just read that passage for us when you were there at St. Paul's talking with Archibald Cox.
All right. Mr. Cox thought a moment. God forbid he should go for the cross-examination. I added more. Black concerns here at school may look different, but are not really from the concerns that my parents have taught me all my life at home. I put that one in just so he'd know that I had a family. And believe me, sir, my mom and daddy did not put President Nixon into the White House. We didn't do that. Mr. Cox wrinkled his lean Yankee face into a mischievous smile. His voice whispered mock conspiracy. He leaned toward me. Do you know who Nixon hates worst of all? I shook my head. No, I had no idea. Our kind of people. My ears felt hot. I wanted to jump on the table. I wanted to go back home and forget that I'd ever come. I wanted to take him to West Philly and drop him off at the corner of 52nd and Locust, outside Fufu's Steak Emporium, right by the drug dealers, leave him there without a map or a bow tie, and tell me about our kind of people. The rector gave me a look that urged caution. I fixed my face. What kind of people are those? I asked. Why the educated Northeastern establishment? He said. The rector smiled as if relieved.
The educated Northeastern establishment.
Yes.
That's you.
And I had no idea. And it was a revelation for me.
Several years later, you went back to teach at St. Paul's.
Yeah. Yes.
Then you joined the Board of Trustees.
Yes.
What kind of person are you now?
You can answer that question several ways. What kind of person are you? You can't get away from this this school. I'm an African American who's been educated at this school.
who believes very strongly in giving something back where I got it.
At one point, you say, I don't want to live in one world or the other.
I don't know. I don't know how much it's possible. It's a current struggle. What I've said, I talked to someone about going to talk at a school, and I told him I don't want to make it sound as if I've settled this. You know, I don't have being black in America down pat. You know, I don't have it done yet. You live it a day at a time.
Do you think white and black people are any better able to talk about the fact of race and racial difference now? Or maybe has it gone in the opposite direction?
Well, I don't know about that, frankly. I don't see a whole huge load of change in my own life with people I meet, no.
I guess that's the thing. In many places in the book, you are talking about the kinds of issues that many Americans, including liberal-minded Americans who think of themselves as integrationists, don't seem to talk about.
Forgive me.
Well, this question of, I remember at one point one of the students says to you, what do black men look like? And there's this awkward pause, and you're sorting out how to deal with that question.
Right. Sure that. Yeah, and I had that feeling that for a moment that it was pointless, that I was there for nothing. You know, did it all come down to nothing but this old song of the South? You know, here we are again with this old foolishness, the business about who's attracted to whom and who's better and bad. I mean, we got all of this. We've got this huge muck of mythology all woven into the fabric of America. You know, do black people do it differently? I mean, that kind of stuff.
That's coming up in the question from this girl.
Sure, it's all coming up in that question. And of course, I was no more ready to deal with that. You know, I said I wanted people to deal with me as a black person, but I didn't want to hear that at all, you know. And a lot of me just shut down right then. But that, you know, that doesn't last very long. You get lonely. You want to have people. And some of my best and most supportive friendships came from that group within the black community there that we formed.
And have most of those, that first class of black students, the first few classes of black students, have they performed according to the St. Paul's expectation and according to their family's expectations?
I'm not sure. We came to St. Paul's with different expectations, and when I was there, frankly, I did not know whether we were expected to go out and be, kind of assimilate ourselves into the world of banking and finance and corporate America, or we were supposed to go out and be black entrepreneurs and start a whole kind of second tier, you know, and do that and therefore make jobs and all, or go to the community and all be social workers and doctors. I didn't know, and I talked about it. Yeah, I kept saying to myself, well, what am I going to do with this? What am I going to do with this? What can I possibly do that's worth this? I didn't know. I didn't know what the school expected. I'm not sure that they had a monolithic expectation either. But those people I interviewed, many of them are doing that, and they're doing many different sorts of things. You know, they're a prosecutor in the city of New York. Someone else is working with computers. Someone else is a hospital administrator. Someone else is in investment banking. I mean, it just spans the school teacher. I mean, there's a whole range. And I needed to get that message that there's not just one way to do black. One of the things that the students at St. Paul seemed to have that I envied was a sense of freedom, a sense of, wow, now what shall I do with my life? Whoa, maybe I'll go to India and study Hinduism. Whoa. And I thought to myself, how dare you? Come back here and work, you know? Or that openness that says, whoa, maybe I'll do theology, or maybe I'll stop and go do pottery. And I think it is true that as a black American, you do have a responsibility to help people that... So there is that mandate against going to be a potter off in the woods somewhere, but there is a freedom, and I hope some of us have tapped into it.
Lorene Carey, thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Lorene Carey is the author of Black Ice, a new book just out. And this is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us from All Things Considered. What's coming up this afternoon, Noah?
Hi, Frank. Reports tonight from Kuwait and from Turkey. The rebellion, of course, continuing in Iraq. And Turkey is said to be reconsidering its policy toward its Kurdish minority. 25% of the gas mask passed out during the Scud attacks in Israel now said to have been defective. NPR's Patricia Neiman has another in her series of reports about Teresa Perez, who was in a long-term drug rehabilitation program at Daytop Village, the treatment center in New York State. She's said to be doing so well now that she's teaching in that program as well. Also, a remembrance of William Turnbull, the founder of the North Point Press in California.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Settling into middle age is one of the most difficult things for a rock and roller to pull off gracefully. But rock critic Ken Tucker says that Graham Parker has accomplished it beautifully, at last, on his new album, Struck by Lightning. And this is what it sounds like.
A man smokes and a dog stretches. A woman works and a kick of etches. I'm driving on a road that stretches over the border to America. Over the border to America.
Graham Parker has been little more than a cult star ever since he emerged from England in 1976 with two terrific aggressive albums, Howling Wind and Heat Treatment. Although it was the heyday of punk rock, he was no punk. His music was based on acoustic guitar figures and Bob Dylan's long folk rock melody lines. Parker never rejected the very idea of rock the way the punks did, but he certainly shared their class animus. As a guy who spent his formative years pumping gas in the London suburb of Hackney, he was one steamed little runt of a good musician. Some of this attitude creeps into one of his new songs, the ironically titled When I Was King.
When I was king, I was not nearly the man I am now. I was like anyone sitting on a throne made out of China. When I was king,
Parker's records have never sold well in America, and he's produced only one really exceptional album, Squeezing Out Sparks, in 1979. It contains a great lost rock classic, Discovering Japan, a baffling masterpiece in which Parker compares his lover's body to a map of Japan and manages to sustain that metaphor for the length of the song. But that was 11 years ago, and in that time, Parker has released a string of flops that sounded confused, bitter, and half-hearted. Struck by Lightning breaks his creative slump, and does it in a new, more disarming way.
She said she just wanted a friend, and then she'd be good. Something to play with now and again, and give lots of food. We've got a yard that's big enough, she says he's like a dream.
That's Children and Dogs, about Parker's new life as a happily married man and a positively delighted father. Playing harmonica on that track is, hold on to your nostalgia caps now, John Sebastian of the Lovin' Spoonful. Garth Hudson of the band also plays organ and synthesizer on a few cuts, but for the most part, this is a spare-sounding album, with Parker accompanying his autobiographical lyrics on his own guitar and harmonica. The album title comes from what he thinks of as his amazing good fortune. This former crank believes that being a contented middle-aged guy is as unlikely and unexpected as being struck by lightning. There are times on this album when Graham Parker sounds positively sappy. Ultimately, what makes Struck by Lightning a striking album is that Parker has found a way to convey a profound change in his tough attitude toward the world without denying the musical talent that made him interesting in the first place. He sounds like a revitalized artist. On one of the best songs here, he sings, "The words came out, not twist and shout, 'cause that's not what a grown man writes about. That chapter's over, and I've become the owner of a brand new book." Graham Parker makes growing up seem like no small accomplishment.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Bob Alls, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Frank Browning.
I once read the story of somebody's life. I had a few moments to spare. He was a good man who lived with his wife, with the usual kids in his hair. There was happiness, a lot of weirdness, and a sprinkle of tragedy. I pulled it by chance from a secondhand bin, but it could have been written just for me. Because the words came out, not twist and shout, 'cause that's not what a grown man writes about. That chapter's over, let it go. I found out I'd become the owner of a brand new book.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the art of juggling and the electric pickle with mathematician Ronald Graham of Bell Laboratories. And we discuss the cultural and historical background of the Kurds with writer and anthropologist Bill Beeman from Brown University. I'm Frank Browning. Join us for the next Fresh Air.